Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series. And for those of you who don't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how higher consciousness can play a meaningful role in helping human beings rise to meet our current challenges and make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. I've now held over 60 remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This morning, I am joined by Cynthia Bergeau, and we'll continue this discussion in a conversation entitled An Evolutionary Encounter with the Integral Christ. The way this will work is I'll introduce Cynthia, and then we'll dialogue for about an hour. Then I'll make some announcements, and we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions. So we'll finish up in about 90 minutes, or perhaps a little longer. Cynthia Bergeau is a Christian mystic, an Episcopal priest, a writer, and an internationally known leader of contemplative retreats who's helped thousands of people to deepen in centering prayer. She's worked closely with Father Thomas Keating, Bruno Barnhart, Richard Rohr, as well as many other contemplative teachers and leaders, Christian and non-Christian. She's the founding director of both the Contemplative Society and the Aspen Wisdom School, and she's the author of 7 books, including her most recent, The Meaning of Mary Magdalene, as well as The Wisdom Jesus and Centering Prayer and Inner Awakening. She divides her time between solitude at her seaside hermitage in Maine and a demanding schedule traveling globally to teach. Something I deeply appreciate about Cynthia is that she integrates diverse virtues. You know, first, there's her combination of spiritual depth, a real contemplative practice and that is not common, and intellectual rigor. She's a sophisticated modern and postmodern scholar, as well as a contemplative and a mystic practitioner. And so in that sense, she's something like a pandit, which is a name Ken Wilber uses for himself, integrating inner knowing with outer study. Second, she also is really walking a path of action and service. She's influenced thousands of people, serving the awakening of a Christ consciousness that I recognize from a practice that's not so much inside the Christian contemplative tradition as profound awakened consciousness. And she's helped catalyze this in thousands of people. So she's an activist, effectively advancing the evolution of culture, and she understands and embodies it all as a single matter. That is, her study, her contemplative practice, her service are not like facets. They're just all expressions of who she is. And so that integration of these virtues in her own being is an expression of the integral spirit that I teach in. I also very much appreciate her deep reading of the original and the newly discovered lost Gospels. And in doing that, I think she's really advanced contemporary understanding, that is esoteric understanding, deep knowing of what it is to contact the living spiritual transmission that can be known from the life of Jesus. And her grappling with the deepest questions I find really most interesting, like what was Jesus really teaching and inviting people to, and how can we respond now directly to that living spiritual invitation, and how does that require and empower us to live our lives? And finally, I really like that she's willing to stand up and be counted as a critic of hypocrisy and institutional and religious confusion. And she does it with a wry and sometimes tart sense of humor, no less. So welcome, Cynthia. I'm honored and delighted to have you with me today on this program.
Well, thank you very much, Terry. And wow, what an introduction. I say, do I know this person? But thank
oh, come
you.
On. That's
thank
you.
Yeah.
Well, in this conversation today, I'm kind of thinking there's something we can do that maybe a chance to do in other dialogues, which is to link this huge body of work that you embody and that you do with me in a dialogue that identifies, you know, the integral Christ or an evolutionary view. And so I think if we're to do that, though, we need a foundation. And maybe you could say in the most direct and simple way, what is your understanding of what Jesus was really offering or teaching and its relevance to people today, to you and to those you relate with, and how we can live lives that really respond to that invitation?
Well, in a nutshell, I'd say that I believe that Jesus was the first non-dual teacher that the West had ever seen. By the West, I mean the Semitic lands onward. He arose in the sequence of the great succession of the prophets of the Hebrew tradition, and I sometimes see him as the one who follows and is supposed to be the technician for a great summons, the great promise given to the prophet Isaiah, when the Lord says, I will take away their hearts of stone and give them a heart of flesh. I will write the law in their heart, and then they shall be my people, and I shall be their God. So I think Jesus came as the master cardiologist, in a way, to mm-hmm. do this kind of heart surgery, which would allow people to perceive and to act in the world as a unified whole, which we now recognize is a function of what we call non-dual consciousness. So he came as the first exemplar and teacher of specifically non-dual consciousness in the West. And he also left us a practice for beginning to stabilize that kind of, catalyze and then stabilize that kind of consciousness within us. Unfortunately, both that insight and the practice itself was completely misinterpreted by the institutional Christianity that couldn't rise to the wingspan he'd set before them.
Mm. Yeah. And that profundity, which you've described in a kind of, from a bird's eye view, a non-dual realization, a radical non-dual realization, that represents an opportunity or an invitation to everyone listening to us as we speak right now. What is that invitation? What is that opportunity?
Well, I believe that Jesus was on to the fact early on that what we call non-dual consciousness, what he called the kingdom of heaven, really requires a transformation of the structures of the brain and the brain-heart rewiring. And I think at the heart of everything he left, running as a sort of golden thread through the parables, through the teachings, through his own modeling, there is a core practice and a core understanding of how to practice that if we begin to practice it today, particularly with what we know and what we see confirmed from neuroscience, we'll begin to predispose or dispose our brains and our brain-heart wiring to a non-dual vision and action and integral practice. So I think it's all there to be discovered. I think it's time to take Jesus down off his pedestal that the church has put him on for all sorts of, good religious reasons, and open the package that he's handed to us and begin to work with it so that we can begin to do what he actually invited us to do.
Mm-hmm. And so the practice that you usually teach is centering prayer, which is very like the meditation practices that come to us from Buddhist and Vedantin and other Eastern traditions, in that it is a deep absorption in the present moment with, you know, in a kind of non-conceptual way. But there's a different element in centering prayer, this consenting to the presence of God.
Yeah.
And in that way, it seems to perhaps to a superficial mind not to be non-dual. It seems to be about a relationship between the practitioner and God rather than dissolution of the practitioner in the non-dual field. How can you help to unpack how that path takes advantage of this invitation to a non-dual awakening?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think the language of Christianity, and as a matter of fact, the language of the whole Abrahamic West, is couched in personal language. And that's a real difference from the Eastern traditions. And when the Eastern traditions came to the West and began to set a new benchmark, as it were, for understanding the non-dual, they brought along with it a kind of prejudice that the impersonal or transpersonal was sort of on a higher order and was part of the turf of the non-dual. And I think that the West is coming back to challenge that and say that you can't get beyond the personal. But we'll save that later. I just want to flag that point. I believe that one of the real differences and one of the real ways in which Christianity and centering prayer moves toward the non-dual is really, really interesting, is that in most of those great meditation practices which you've described, it's assumed that you go toward dissolution in the all by way of the first step is learning to hold a fixed and concentrated awareness, a single point awareness. So concentration or directed attention is usually the starting gate for anything else that follows. What centering prayer suggests is we bypass even focused attention and simply practice a very very minor and very very interesting, rather embodied gesture of letting go. And in dualistic language, as you've read it, this is called consenting, and it sounds like consenting to a God who is out there and is somebody else from what you are. So when you read the language that describes the prayer, it will sound like knuckling under to the big guy. But what you are actually doing is you are suspending the subject-object configuration of your attention. What you do in centering prayer is it says very clearly in the instructions that anything you put your attention on is a thought, and a thought is the thing that you have to let go of. So this gives people who are really working in dualistic language and categories a hard time when they learn the prayer. You mean I have to let go of God? And the answer is yes. You mean I have to let go of my bliss? Yes. You mean I have to let go of my state of nirvana? Yes. But this repeated practice of withdrawing attention from that subject-object configuration and learning to hold it essentially in a state of pure awareness in which there is only being, not I and the pole of my attention, that really is a non-dual state. And I think the radical discovery that Jesus made and that Thomas Keating reinforced as he worked with centering prayer is that you can learn to move toward that non-dual state, not necessarily through the starting gate of focusing attention on a single object, but simply releasing attention from all objects. And it gets you there by a different route.
Well, beautiful. You know, this is provocative. I did a good deal of my sadhana in a tradition that was very influenced by Kashmir Shaivism, which is an Indian tradition that is both non-dual and Vedantin and about the capital S self, but which also embraces dualism and in the devotional relationship to the Shakti, the knowing of the unity of Shiva and Shakti. And so it kind of straddles this paradox, you know, very overtly. And part of what I was initiated into was an appreciation for the way my teacher used to put it, was the difference between the school that is alive to the living God and the schools that are talking schools, that understand these things abstractly and are kind of dharmically quite radical and profound, but which don't have the same relationship to the profound power of divinity itself. And I wonder, in the description you just offered, it seems as though, you know, in each discussion we always emphasize something and something else gets de-emphasized necessarily. But in that discussion, it seems to suggest that meditation is really just about an abstracted state, and yet isn't there a living power of divinity that is really the nature of every moment and the nature even of every thought and the nature of us and the nature of anything or anyone into whom relationship we might find our way through meditation, which is incredibly powerful and potent and real? And isn't that an important aspect of what can be unlocked through this practice of consenting to the presence of God?
Oh, certainly. Oh, certainly. I mean, I think that one of the things that we sort of gloss right over is, by the very etymology of the word, consciousness begins with con, which means with, and shisness means knowing. So consciousness is just by its root knowing with, and it implies a relational universe. And I keep wondering why this incredibly important point is so often overlooked, so that consciousness looks like either the great I or the great it, you know, Ken's God in first person and God in third person, where what we realize is that the nature of universe within consciousness, which is about all we can do as human beings, is always going to be relational, which means that thou, God in second person, is going to be the deepest and, in a way, the most integrating experience we can have of the very nature of God. And this is what I was sort of alluding to when I talked about that there is such a thing as a non-dual personal, and that the Western traditions has testified to this in a primitive but, I think, accurate way. So centering prayer does begin to lead us into this experience of pure intimacy, which is the field, which is the heart of God in which we live and move and have our being. And it is profoundly real, profoundly rich, and profoundly generative. And my sense always is that there's a tendency to demonize dualism. The world is dual, and there's nothing that you can do, not even with the loftiest of mind, to override that condition, because that is the condition in which something very, very precious is being spoken here about the nature of reality. And if duality weren't required, it wouldn't be here. But the sense that, you know, we need to transcend dual perception and perceive from oneness so that we can celebrate and, in a good way, manifest and transform this extraordinary warp and weft of duality, which allows the tapestry of love to appear. So that's how I hook it together.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. That was lovely. In the title of this dialogue, I used this phrase, the integral Christ. Does that resonate for you? And if so, how would you describe that integral Christ?
Well, I would say that certainly works well. And for me, the integral, and this has been right there in the doctrines of the Church since the 4th century, but not with these words, is there is a complete continuity between the human realm and the divine realm, so that the two are so inextricably fused that we as humans in the model of Christ, who is the great archetype for us, understand and accept and embrace the fact that human beings somehow in the world, somehow or another, stand at the junction point of the infinite and the finite. T.S. Eliot used to say, to live at the intersection of the timeless with time is the occupation of a saint. And I think it's the essential nature of the human condition. So an integral practice for me is really about that. It's the meaningful wedding together, reuniting of the finite and the infinite in the human soul, in this dimension of, in the conditions of duality, in such a way that the light of non-duality glows through the whole thing.
Mm. Yeah, lovely. Now, I would like to kind of take that another step further, another word that I often use to describe my own teaching, besides integral, is evolutionary. And there are a number of key discoveries or epiphanies that have shifted the spirituality and even the self-sense of many people, even in the last just few years, and certainly in the last 20 years, which are informed by this rapidly advancing granularity and detail of human understanding of our larger context, of the 13.7 billion years of cosmic evolution, the millions of years of biological evolution, and the tens of thousands of years of human cultural evolution and the evolution of human consciousness, and the recognition that our minds necessarily operate in terms of language and syntax with subjects and objects, and yet we am a process that is continually self-recreating and which is always naturally transcending and including all that came before, and which has an entelechy, a directionality. It is an acorn that implies an oak, and that we are moving, and that there is a kind of creativity and purpose in all of it, and that it isn't just an endless wheel of birth and death. And it kind of breaks the spell of solidity, as Carter Phipps likes to say. Has that vision of evolution shifted or informed or in any way made some important contribution to your understanding and practice of spirituality and mysticism? How does it relate?
Well, I would say yes, 100%, and I agree. You know, my spirituality is very much informed by that great Christian Jesuit mystic Teilhard de Chardin, who essentially caught and beautifully talked about the evolutionary nature of the divine back, you know, nearly 100 years ago now, to the horror of the church, but who actually saw Christ as, well, he talked about the third nature of Christ being actually a force that has entered the marrow of the earth as the drive shaft of evolution. So these concepts are there anyway. I have approached it by nature, by the root of the Trinity, and we can talk about that more or not talk about it more as you wish. It's a trailer out there. But my sense is very, very strongly that we are on the edge of what many call the second axial period, that just as in the time around basically 500 BC, the consciousness of humanity seemed to leap forward spontaneously across the globe into what we might call egoic thinking and an individual sense of selfhood. Now it's right massing to jump forward into a new collectivity in which we can think from the whole to the part without doing violence to either whole or part. And I think that we see nowadays this great movement forward because it's happening. It's real. And it is, you know, it seems to be reaching in a critical mass in our own time, which makes our own era so tremendously exciting and so tremendously dicey.
Beautiful. There's so much that's so rich in that. I want to pick up on this ability to think from whole to part first, because it seems to me that although you did use the word think, and I think it's not inappropriate, it seems to rest on what in some quarters is called gnosis, something deeper than mere thought, certainly not merely informational, conceptual thinking. And therefore, perhaps does need the foundation of some profundity of contemplative practice, such that there is a shift of identity sufficient that this is these are not mere ideas that are kind of grasped as you know from the place of ego, but which are there's sort of a centerless way of knowing that is implicit here, which would require then some critical mass of people who've actually had some level of deep mystical practice and awakening in order to co-create that kind of reality, that knowing of ourselves together. Is that accurate to your experience and perception about this?
Oh yeah, I think that's exactly true. And of course, in the Western tradition, contemplation has not classically meant what we nowadays in a kind of shorthand do, meaning silence and no thinking. It means thinking with the mind and the heart. Thinking, gnosis comes from the Greek word nous, which means a higher intellect of knowing which can only occur when the mind is in the heart. And that whole teaching, put the mind in the heart, has been a sort of theme song and logo of the Eastern Orthodox tradition for, you know, 1,500 years or more. So what we're actually talking about is new brain structures which don't cancel out the capacity to, you know, to use the mind at its finest way in what Ken Wilber would call the teal levels, the inspired visionary logic. That's all part of what a human being can do. But to go on beyond just vision logic really requires the mind and the heart in a new way, and accompanying and supportive neurological structures which will allow that to come into being. And I think that what gives me some confidence to say that we are converging on a second axial is because this practice, particularly the worldwide growth of meditation, has begun to set in motion the neurological processes which allow these attitudes to become stages, not states.
Stabilized, therefore, not just coming and going.
Yeah, I mean, you can't teach an egoic mind whose whole perceptive structure is founded on differentiation to see from unity. It's an oxymoron. You have to begin to develop the structures which can see from unity. It's a kind of holographic seeing, which certainly the tradition, particularly the illumined mystical tradition of the Christian East, has known intimately. But it always gets lost in translation when it comes west and when it comes into dualistic language.
Interesting. Now, in the spirit of really honoring your tradition, because although within the ways that Christianity is understood and lived in our contemporary world, you're something of a radical and an iconoclast, you are staying and, well, maybe staying isn't even the right word, but you root yourself so richly in that tradition. Obviously, you love it, and I am curious, appreciating that you're wise to its, to the limitations that have turned me and others off to the forms of Christianity that we've encountered. there's still been something that is precious and profound that maybe is something you would recommend even to someone who already has a fairly deeply developed mystical life. Perhaps that has something to do with your understanding of the Trinity. Perhaps that has something to do with your way of relating even to the metaphysical accretions that people like me would like to cast off. I know for me, I was raised in an intentional Christian community, and I had a connection to Christianity, but my spirituality really arose out of, you might say, the secular humanism that was also part of my upbringing, and out of the kind of existential crises that drew me into a transrational consciousness, and then the discovery of a kind of non-dual mysticism from the East, and then my ability then to feel resonant with Christianity has always been about reinterpreting the language and ideas of Christianity from this perspective that is integral, that is universal, that is not, you know, it isn't, in other words, my mysticism didn't kind of come up from the roots of that Christian tradition. It's a re-encounter with Christianity and a reinterpretation of it from a spirituality that was encountered in universal terms. And I wonder if I hadn't kind of gotten outside the tent, if my growth beyond the rational would have been compromised by so many of the, I think, you know, pre-rational confusions that I encounter in some of, you know, so much of the Christian literature. So I want to give you a chance to advocate for what's rich and good and healthy in that Christian tradition and why it might be a source of inspiration and sustenance and clarification even for those who've rejected it.
Well, there's a tall order. I think I would say, just as a sort of, you know, to set the general turf, is that one of my favorite sayings is from that British satirist G.K. Chesterton, who said that Christianity isn't a failure, it just hasn't been tried yet. And I think that what people are reacting against is, and it breaks my heart, is the distorted forms, which are all, in some sense, Mercator projections of Christianity. You know what happens to the globe when you push it into two dimensions. Greenland and Antarctica get hideously distorted on the map. And I think that Christianity is simply a three-dimensional global experience which can't be downloaded into two dimensions. So what most people are dealing with and rejecting are Mercator projections of Christianity, but unfortunately those things are so violently defended that the turnoff factor is high. I would say just to set the turf in a second way, that there has been a long time in my life when I would have said, you know, oh my God, why the Christian path? If I could have jumped ship and been a Sufi, I would have done it hands down many times over. Why do they have so much fun? Why can you have ecstatic experiences? Why is it so simple on other paths? And why am I stuck with this path which is so damn stubborn and cranky and contrary? But there really was never any choice, because my call to this path came in the middle of very intense particularity, where I showed up at a communion service completely by accident. I thought I was going to a performance by a boy choir, and wound up receiving communion for the very first time at the age of 20. And in that experience, I knew absolutely the reality, the personal reality of the risen Christ, and that he is my spiritual teacher. And that, so in order to jump ship and join another path, I would have to disown my own imaginal knowing. And that's a big no-no on the spiritual path. Once you're given to know from that noetic place, you have to stick with a relationship of that knowing. So for better or for worse, Christianity is the path I'm walking. But that's not at any sense a begrudging anymore, because to get to the third part of your question, if I were to advocate for Christianity, what I think it understands that so many of the great religions of the world have just lost is the preciousness of this sphere, and the absolute necessity of what goes on, the preciousness, the sacredness of what happens in this sphere, to the whole revelation of the heart of God, or as you might say in more non-dual terms, of global entelechy. That so many of the religions founded in that axial period all have as their common denominator that there's something wrong with this planet, and you have to get out of it, either by recognizing it as Maya or illusion, by seeing it's an exile that you get home from. But there's a sense, even in the words in the great four or five states of spiritual consciousness, every California Valley girl knows that gross is gross. And we feel like spirituality is a matter of spiritualization, where we have to see through and move out of the very solidity of the here and now. And I think this is a great mistake. It's a great, it's a skew of the perennial philosophy that grows out of the alienated human nature of human consciousness. And it really gets in the way of the nowness of incarnation. And so I think Christianity, with its epicenter in Jesus and the statement that God so loved the world that he sent his only son, ideally encourages us to turn back into this realm, to turn back into the very conditions of solidity and density and duality and gravity, and realize that in this place and through this, the most exquisite dimensions of the intimacy of the whole field are being revealed. So that's why I stay with it. I think there's something that's correctly configured here. And granted that most people have not gotten to it and have taken it, it's always kind of perplexed me why a religion whose epicenter is in incarnation should wind up with its praxis being in denying the world and hating the body. That's go figure. But at least in theory, there is the possibility to bridge and to state in a particularly beautiful way how the here-ness of this sphere is not a mistake, not a veil, but the heart itself of divine love.
Mm. I know that what keeps me, even after my long journeys into Eastern practice, what has kept me really resonant with Christianity is that message of love, that the love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. That heartbreaking recognition of love, even the intensity of feeling that is, sometimes it goes into perverted directions, but there's something about that image of Christ's blood sacrifice on the cross that's about loving, it's the wound of love, loving so much that all is given, and that love that hurts, that is what I arrive at in my most profound awakenings. I am given over in love to life in a way that is very much resonant with that spirit of what it seems most beautiful in the story of Jesus and in the very loving spirit that I see in many Christians, even fundamentalist Christians, are often overjoyed at the heart with this sense of loving communion with a God who loves them so much that it breaks their hearts. And that seems always to be the wonderfully healthy thing in Christianity.
Exactly, exactly. You know, for me, love is, of course, a universal force, and that it, yet it glows so brightly in the finite. And what I understand by Eucharistic love, as they call it in Christianity, is that capacity to have your heart broken without resorting to bitterness or cynicism, you know, to just stand there and suffer the wound of love. And out of that pours this incredible, I think, quintessential expression of what the divine heart is. It's the formless in form to the glory of love. And I think we have wonderful models and wonderful inclinations and intimations of that in Christianity, perhaps in the most sacred and pure way. I know you told a little bit of your story, and so my story was I came from the other direction, that I was raised, although in a Christian tradition, in Christian Science. And I learned God and spirit as the great third person, as the great I, it, as cosmic principles that could be applied. And what really began my walk back to Christianity and my conversion in a big way was when I was 17 years old, and we'd been practicing in my high school choir, singing the Fore Requiem, which is a beautiful piece, a beautiful, beautiful setting of the Requiem text for, you know, for the Mass for the Dead. And it so happened that tragedy struck as we were preparing our performance, and one of the kids a year younger than me who was singing tenor was killed in a car crash. And his parents, who were Catholic, asked that we would perform the Fore Requiem at the Catholic Church as a, you know, a memorial to Harry. And we did it, and I remember just waves and waves of something that had been missing all my life breaking over me. The simple, aha, you know, we don't have to deny the reality of death, of brokenness. All we have to do is reach out in love and comfort each other with beauty and tenderness. And what went on for me that night in the simple joy of beauty and tenderness, I think anchored my feet to this earth and to this path more than anything else.
Thank you. Well, now, there's another question that I want to probe into, because, you know, you're traveled in the kind of inner world very deeply, but you also travel pretty widely in the outer world, and you connect with people on these deep levels. And I imagine that you're seeing something like what I'm seeing, which is a seriousness and an actuality of awakening much more widely. That something you might call Christ consciousness is spontaneously coming forward, I hope, in contemplative Christian practitioners all over. And I'm curious what patterns you're observing. In what ways do you see something new or something accelerating? You know, does this give you a cause for hope? What impresses you most?
Well, I mean, what impresses me the most is that it's practice-based, and particularly meditation-based. And at this point, I can't share enough gratitude for my teacher, Thomas Keating, and for the really deep and faithful witness of the Benedictine, and particularly the Trappist monastic tradition, where the simple practice every day of simply sitting down on the cushion, sitting down in Lectio Divina, is basically stabilizing a different kind of frame of reference in the brain and in the brain-heart connection. And what Thomas Keating did that is so magnificent, and what is his great gift to humanity and his great gift to consciousness, is he gave Christians a practice that would allow them to begin to access this non-dual transformation of their consciousness in actual practice, in actual apophatic practice, rather than in rhetoric and excitement and beautiful statements and, you know, all the froth on the top of the milk. He's given them something that actually is getting down to cases. And as I run my wisdom schools around and about the country, what I see very clearly is that without a good, stable basis in meditation, people simply go running off wild with ideas. They get intoxicated on ideas. And I see too much sort of spacey talk about non-dual and non-dual, like it's just the latest new buzzword, without the real transformation of the structures of brain, heart, you know, of wiring that will allow that to be just a quiet, humble reality. So what I'm seeing that's new is the capacity to actually approach this not as an idea, but as a unit of vision grounded in practice. And I think that's huge in Christianity, because we haven't had it much in Christianity at all, and we certainly haven't had it in the world, in the laity, and in the external religions.
That's beautiful. Are there... I'm curious, are there any anecdotes you'd like to share as to how you're seeing that manifest? And to what degree is it maybe a source of hope? Because, you know, part of the framing of this whole series is the sense, you know, that we're in a crisis time and that we can't solve our problems with the kind of consciousness that created them. So, you know, does our mystical practice perhaps show signs of, you know, giving us a leg up on meeting the challenges of our time and of our world?
Well, I think it does. And you know, I'm just reminded of a nasty little comment that a hermit made, a real hermit in the Trappist order, about Thomas Merton, who said, "Ah, yes, Thomas Merton, the little silence he knew, he wrote about very well." And I think it's the tendency of the world, and particularly one of the things that concerns me, it's a double-edged sword, is the kind of excitement and froth and generated energy around, oh, there's a change coming, there's a convergence, there's a cosmic harmony, there's a new, you know, and you feel the energy of it, and in one sense you have to speak it out so that you can at least articulate it so that it reaches critical mass. But on the other hand, that very excitement and that very urgency are run counter to the deep rivers of this transformed consciousness. And so you have to be careful there. I think you asked me for an anecdote, and one that I remember that just really sticks in my heart is that, you know, I spend many, many holy weeks out at St. Benedict's Monastery, where Thomas Keating lives, a wonderful Trappist community out in Snowmass, Colorado. And I was speaking with one of the monks who was going to be the celebrant on Good Friday, and he said to me, I was telling him about this really cool service we had had out in the church where, you know, we had been celebrating Mary Magdalene's part in a really rich way. And he just sort of shook his head and said, you know, we're so bound here, we can't even change a word in the liturgy. It's always just the same as it was. I feel sorry about it. And I said, well, you know, you hold the space with your being. And that's all that was said. But the next day, he came and just very, very simply conducted the liturgy for Good Friday. There was absolutely nothing different on the surface. The old words were there, the old, you know, the things that everybody does when they go to St. Benedict's for 20 or 30 years, it was all right there. And yet he held it from a depth dimension which was so palpable that everybody in that room was in tears and were weeping afterwards. They got Good Friday. And for me, that became a symbol that, you know, the means and the ends have to match. And if the unitive or the non-dual is a depth dimension, then it has to be carried in our bearing, in our heart, not in the frothy egoic utterance, but in some solid deep current of the river. And I think my real happiness and what really gives me hope, because millennialist movements come and go, but I'm seeing more and more people that are beginning to approximate in life that quiet depth. You know, they don't have to have it exciting. It can be ordinary and it can be simple, but it's done from a place of unity, so that what flows out of it is unity.
Mm. Beautiful. Well, this maybe brings us to the last question I think I probably have time to ask you before our break and our time of taking questions from folks. And maybe what I can pick up on is this theme of pointing to contemplative depth is one that, you know, from some perspectives is at least complimented, if not, I wouldn't say it's necessarily criticized, but people might say, well, we need contemplatives. We need people whose lives are more active too. And so what other roles are necessary to contemplate the role of the contemplative? To what degree does a contemplative life provide the foundation for lives of action? And you know, do you recommend that the people you teach become more like you, with part of their time spent more as hermits, or not? And if so, why or why not? And therefore, you know, how does contemplative practice, you know, what is its part in a larger whole, or what is its role as a kind of wholeness for other apparently different styles of living?
Well, we have to get away from an old kind of cliche that really doesn't work, that juxtaposes or polarizes contemplation and action. We like to think of the contemplative as the one who's just sitting there on their butts in some sort of cave, and the activist as one who's out pushing the pieces of the world around. And this has really been a false dichotomy from the start. When you look even at the great founder of the whole Christian stream of monasticism, St. Anthony, yes, he sat in a cave for 20 years, but then he emerged and had a kind of regular rhythm in his life between withdrawal and action. And Thomas Merton, at the other end of the bookend, you know, had deep silence but also deep engagement. And so did Jesus. And I think what we're really looking at in the people who are the great contemplatives is a rhythmic movement between times of withdrawal from busyness, but not because God's there in the silence, but rather because we often, if we don't stay fresh, we hide out in activity and we lie to ourselves and we get feeling self-important, and so we fall back into egoic action. So you can do a silence cleanse, but that doesn't mean you're a contemplative. I mean, everybody, you know, Thomas Keating likes to say, real silence inside is not the absence of noise, but the absence of hiding. And that's certainly what I learned from my own hermit teacher at the monastery at St. Benedict's. So the contemplative is a person that wants to live against face to face with life in a infinite honesty, to be willing to live at that intersection of the timeless with time, as Thomas or T.S. Eliot said, consciously, and to flow out into the world without disturbing either the action or the silence by egoic noise. And as the ego dwindles, as you know, there's a beautiful quote from one of the great Christian spiritual teachers, Gerald May, who says that as attachment ceases to be our motivation, our actions become reflections of compassion absolute. So unattached action flows out from a space of infinite silence and spaciousness and brings the dimensions of that silence and infinite spaciousness into the finite form of action. And so I think that withdrawing into physical solitude is simply part of the whole circle of participating in this great flow. It keeps us honest, it keeps us simple, and it keeps us clean. But if we don't flow back out, it simply keeps us safe and insulated and self-congratulatory. So the whole thing is the contemplative life in my point of view.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. I could go on for hours with you, but it is time for some announcements. And first, I'd like to make sure that everybody knows how to find out more about your work. Contemplative.org, the Contemplative Society, has a wonderful website with Cynthia's teaching schedule, a list of articles and links to download and read several PDFs, connections to some audios. There are also videos of her on YouTube. Is there anything in particular, Cynthia, that you'd like to make sure people are aware of?
No, I mean, I can't thank my good friends in British Columbia enough at the Contemplative Society who've taken on the job of really holding that website and keeping it contemporary and current and available for anyone who wants to check where I am. There's the links to my books. You can also find them on Amazon.com. But anything you need to know to jump into my orbit is certainly there.
Well, great. So that's contemplative.org.
Yep.
Okay.
We grabbed that easy moniker back in 1997 when it was still available.
Yeah, good move.
Yeah.
Well, I want everyone to be aware of some of my own offerings. First, this Wednesday, August 8th at 5 p.m., the really remarkable Austrian spiritual teacher Thomas Hubel and I will be available to answer questions regarding especially a one-year program that we're launching called Birthing a New We. So if you're at all interested in that, please go to birthinganewwe.com. You can sign up there and you'll get the call-in information. And if you can't be there live, there'll be information on how to download the recording to listen to it later. For a full year beginning in September, we're going to be coming together with a group of committed evolutionary practitioners to co-create a spiritual consciousness and culture and to experiment with this we space and the depth of consciousness that is so often only experienced individually and what can be done mutually. Thomas transmits a tremendously spacious, subtle energetic field in which a kind of delicacy of attention becomes possible. And by combining that with integral practice and a kind of deep sincerity, this group will be engaging quite an experiment. The program's already three-quarters sold out. There aren't that many spaces left. So if you're at all curious, please come and check it out at birthinganewwe.com. And then secondly, as everybody knows, in the United States, this is an election year. And I know many of you are from other countries, and I know that there are some who don't agree with my political views. I respect that, and I certainly invite you and encourage you to, you know, engage with other aspects of things where we're maybe more congruent. But I think everybody can agree it's an important time for us all to be engaged. And spirituality, if it's really lived, requires being a citizen of this world. So for myself, I think it's pretty important that Barack Obama be reelected as our president in the United States. So I've created a website, integralobama.com. I'm concerned that the better part of $1 billion that's been donated by a few super wealthy individuals through super PACs is going to be spent on negative ads against the president in the swing states. If he's not reelected, I think it's really going to be a kind of a disaster for our country and the world and even for our planetary environment. And if that happens, it'll be because we didn't close the spending gap when we could. So I want to contribute funds to help make sure he's reelected. But I also feel so dissatisfied and frustrated with the level of political dialogue in this country. I'd like an integral evolutionary point of view and perspectives to be much more influential. So I think there's a value in a group of us pooling our donations so that perhaps together we can have more influence than we could just giving our money separately, so that some higher perspectives have a better chance of getting a serious hearing. So I encourage anyone who's thinking of donating to the president's reelection campaign to go to integralobama.com and make your donations there so that we can pool our contributions and our influence and help reelect the president. I think it's a very worthy cause. You can also connect with me and be able to find out more about all of my activities, and please sign up for my mailing list, which is different from the Beyond Awakening list, by visiting terrypatten.com, T-E-R-R-Y-P-A-T-T-E-N, not like the general, terrypatten.com. And please stay on the line. At the end of this call, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with our guests in the months ahead. In 3 weeks, on August 26th, I'll be speaking with integral philosopher Steve McIntosh. And so please hang on. I'll tell you all about that. Okay, so if you have a question and you've dialed in on the phone, dial *2 to raise your hand, *2, and we can take your questions live. So please dial *2, and we'll be able to hear your voice live. And if you've been listening on the webcast, please go ahead and type in your questions, and we can take some of them. All right. Well, we have a question right away from, oh gosh, there's quite a few here. Al Kramer in Naperville, Illinois, asks, so much of what's been taught in recent times concerning wisdom is concerned with individual awakening and personal growth. Are we reaching a time when the resources are available to enable a human capacity to see and act out of a common source of wisdom? Are we developing group perspectives along the growth of a wisdom path? Not an individual perspective, but a shared perspective that has developed into a wisdom level?
Well, thank you, Al Kramer, for that question. I would say yes, indeed, and this is exactly what I've been talking about. But there's, the Axial Age that really got started about 500 BC around the world was supremely the age of the individual, and the great evolutionary step forward there is to understand that we have, each one of us, an individual relationship with divinity. But even at the time of Christ and just after, there was the beginning of a sense that there was a greater collectivity that wasn't based on going back to a kind of uniform tribal consciousness, what Thomas Keating calls mythic membership consciousness, but a kind of holographic vision of reality. And St. Paul was hitting that beautifully in his wonderful image of we are all parts of the body of Christ, that we have to think from the whole body rather than from our individual parts. And Paul went on in this sublime way to say, the heart can't call sete to the liver, I have no use for you, on and on and on. And so it's that kind of thinking which is going to be characteristic of the axial period. And the important thing to say is that it's not just a kind of 1960s collectivity, we're all one at a horizontal level. It really starts from seeing and thinking in terms of a greater whole, of a greater unity or oneness that we all flow out from. Pluralism, and what Ken Wilber so beautifully talks about is that green level, is it's the whole is combined of a whole bunch of little me's. and it won't work at that level. So it's a collectivity which is held from a sense that we are all one body in Christ, in humanity, in whatever way you want to name it, but there is a greater organizing unit than the individual. And it requires non-dual consciousness to think from that place. So that's what's coming up. Yes, indeed, Al, and centering prayer does help us begin to lay down the groundwork for that sort of transition.
Beautiful. Thank you. You know, I would say I think there's a lot of excitement right now in the integral and evolutionary communities about this idea of a higher we. I'm going to be at a integral community seminar in Loveland, Colorado next week. I didn't announce it because it's probably a little too late for folks to make plans to be there, but it's August 13th through 19th, and the theme of that is evolving the we. And this year-long I mentioned with Thomas Hubel is all about birthing a new we. There are even several people in academic institutions, particularly Olin Gunlicks and in Canada, who are just studying what he thinks is the manifestation of a new phenomenon in which people are entering into a transpersonal states together and a new kind of activated, integral, higher, intersubjective intelligence is being tapped into, that's kind of drawing people beyond what they could necessarily. It's not just entering into something subjectively, but then something intersubjective drawing the individual up to a higher level of consciousness. Is that something that you see going on among Christians too?
Oh, yes. And of course, the whole Judeo-Christian tradition has always had this mystical, esoteric image of the Adam Kadmon, the one body, the one Christ. And so there's this powerful sense that the that we are all, at this individual level, we're all just little cells. And what is really carrying this is not, the we is not an I writ large, but a higher person or a higher personal that is radiating back down again to pull people into oneness. I have a wonderful friend, a Theravada Buddhist, who likes to quip, what's the plural of egoic? We-goic. And we have to be always very, very careful, and this is again why I emphasized earlier that froth not come into it, that the we, that this higher we really comes from an organization, in a sense a giving up and a relinquishment of a certain level of personal autonomy to form into, to become bodies in a higher collective unit. And that's why you can say so keenly that it is a new evolutionary movement, because that's what's happened at every level of evolution in the planet so far. Things, little cells have come together to form some new kind of higher collectivity. A whole bunch of little crystal cells come together to form a whatever it is. So we really have to move to understanding that this isn't just a big happy camper thing, but is a relinquishment of what we've used to think was our individual freedom, our individual realization, our individual salvation. There is no such thing as individual salvation or individual realization in a higher collectivity.
Beautiful. That's a very important point. I love that we give up our immunity, our personal cave in that higher we.
Yeah.
Thank you. There are quite a few people who want to hear you talk more about the Trinity, Cynthia, and I'd like to read a few of the words they've offered to kind of give you a sense of the direction of their specific interests. Michelle Brown from Victoria, Canada, says that you link the Trinity to an understanding of evolution. and she'd really like to hear about that specifically. There's a request from Jim Clark, who's an Episcopal priest and longtime centering prayer practitioner, said he was grateful to hear you articulate the importance of the personal and the dual within the non-dual vision. Your perspective seemed unusually insightful to him, and he's planning to re-listen to that section of the recording. Would you be able to say more about the relationship between the dual and non-dual nature of reality as you experience it? Let me see. Here it is. Al Braywood from Kanaohe, I think, Hawaii, says, I'm pretty sure there's something tremendously important in the Trinity that contributes directly to our evolutionary actualization. Could Cynthia say a few words about this?
Well, I can give you the short pitch. If all goes well, I'll have a book on this coming out from Shambhala within, you know, probably a year from now, if we're lucky, a year and a half, if I don't get the final chapter of the conclusion written this month. But it's under contract. And what I'm going to do, and it's a rather unusual gambit, is that I'm saying that, you know, that we have behind the Trinity that people are familiar with from doctrinal Christianity, you know, which means a Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, it really is better interpreted as a mandala of change and movement. We ought to pay more attention to the flow of the energy between these three posts, which we just call Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And then I'm going to take it a step farther that nobody's ever gone in before, which is to specifically link it to what in the Gurdjieff work is known as the Law of Three, or the Law of World Creation, and suggest by a lot of reference to work in the Gurdjieff work, which I spent 10 years in, that we really have in the Trinity a mandala that describes in very specific ways how ongoing creation, how ongoing evolution works. Not exactly not in just sort of spiritual, personal, metaphoric terms, but as an actual kind of theorem that you can work with out in the world and in the macrocosm and in the microcosm. So I'm going to show how that's so and suggest that Christianity has all along had this extraordinarily powerful tool to understand how to consciously cooperate with, manage, midwife this evolutionary emergence the divine heart into form and back out of it again. And we haven't realized it. And if we can learn to take the Trinity and use it that way, not as a kind of theological tritheism, but as a very specific, you know, Einsteinian theorem of the interweaving of finite and infinite in new creation. We have a powerful tool for not just for the reawakening of Christianity, but for a transformation of the world.
Beautiful. So would you, I think some people would like to hear you unpack it, you know, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost step by step a little bit. Is there anything along those lines that feels right for you to go into again?
Well, you know, I don't want to say too much because it's a complicated subject and you have to, one of the reasons why it's so hard to get into it is you just can't leap into the middle of it there. There are little foundations that have to be laid down. But I can say a couple of things. The first is that what got me interested in this in the first place was a very, very popular and in some ways perfectly admirable movement which has grown up in Christianity that resists the fact that there are, you know, they say that why should all three persons of the Trinity be male? Shouldn't the Spirit be female. And you can certainly make a strong case here just on the terms of linguistic analysis that the word for spirit in most of the great traditions is feminine. But I found myself digging in my heels against this movement, which is kind of perplexing since I'm, as you say, I tend to be a radical feminist in most other things. But my sense was that this was really bad metaphysics, because what it was collapsing back into a great binary, you know, yin and yang, male and female, darkness and light, these complementary opposites. Whereas the ternary is not about male or female at all, but about a particular way that process unfolds as it weaves between the infinite and the finite. And to try and conform the Trinity to a binary model, or even as Jung likes to say, a quaternity, simply destroys a very much more powerful metaphysical treasure. So part of what I'm trying to do in the book is teach people what ternary metaphysics is and how Christianity, by its inherent affinity to ternary metaphysics, is always a little bit at home, even in the perennial philosophy, which is a great binary system. So I'm thinking in those sort of ways, which will be brand new for most metaphysicians who never heard of anything called ternary metaphysics. There's just plain old metaphysics, or post-metaphysics if you talk with Ken. I'm going to suggest there's ternary metaphysics. The other thing I would say is that in the West, the Trinity, the teachings on the doctrine of the Trinity, split very early on East and West. And the West got into what's called substance theology, which is they just got totally obsessed with trying to figure out the individual streams of personhood of someone called Father and someone called Son and someone called Spirit. The West, or the East, understood from the start that these were not quite such fixed individuals, that they were, the word the East used was hypostasis, which comes much closer to states, just like water can exist in a state of gas or water or ice. They understood that a much more fluid and flowing substance than the West ever got. So I think that since the doctrine of the Trinity basically originated in the East anyway, we're already in the West dealing with a kind of a distortion of the founding insight that's gotten West and worse and worse and worse, which is what's made it so very, very hard for anybody to get into what the doctrine of the Trinity is and why the other religions of the world throw up their hands in despair and say, oh, these Christians with their stupid little Trinity, let's get a life. So anyway, I'm going to try and suggest some new ways of thinking through that, to suggest that it's very important for Christians to be able to claim fully, confidently, the power and the mystery and the esoteric knowledge which has been embedded all along in the Trinity, and bring it forth as our contribution to a non-dual world.
Thank you. Beautiful. Well, I want to take a live question now. This one appears to be listed under the name C. Chapin with a Colorado... So you're live with us. Please introduce yourself. What's your question?
Terry, thank you so much. Cynthia, this has been incredible for me. I am Presbyterian, Episcopalian, out of Bridget's Place in Houston. I'm also centering prayer practitioner 10 days at the monastery, and I'm also doing integral work with Catherine and Claire through some evolving wisdom things. And so I feel like I'm really on the cutting edge, and I've come from very straight Presbyterian. My question is this. I have always had difficulty with understanding how God would have Jesus die on the cross to save me. And I'm in process with trying to make sense out of this. again, I'm living out of the Christian faith, and yet I take all of the rest of this in. It seems to me that the fundamentalist and even the mainline thought about this is in Jesus dying for my sins, then it gives me the escape of not having to be responsible for my life, and also doesn't allow one's own true connection with all the things that you've been talking about and that I experience in all my work with Thomas Ubel. And so I just wonder what your take is about it. I don't have too much problem with the idea of the ascension and Jesus coming back and talking, because I understand there's this great mystical realm that I really don't have full knowledge of. So that's plausible to me. But I don't get this other piece about Jesus dying for me. I more take it that he died in his own integrity, that he lived what he lived, and if they were going to crucify him for it, he wasn't going to try to wiggle out of it in any sense. And so for me, that's a tremendous model of integrity. And I just wonder what your position is, or what you can offer.
Well, I'm 100% in agreement with all you say, that Jesus died for our sins. You know, as you undoubtedly know, the theological name we give to that is atonement theology or substitution theology. And it's bad theology. It came about very, very early on, I think quite mistakenly, in the Jewish takes, particularly in the Pauline take, on what Jesus was doing. And it radically distorts all sorts of pictures. It's radically contradicted by, if nothing else, Jesus himself. And yet it's become dominant. And I think the reason it's become dominant is because of some of the stuff that Ken Wilber talks about so beautifully in his idea of the level and line confusion, that it speaks very well to a certain level of Christianity. It's very much a mythic membership level concept, and that's the level, unfortunately, on which Christianity is being practiced and being identified in the press today. So it's a very prevalent, and you might even say virulent, take on it. But it has absolutely nothing to do with what was going on, as you say. Jesus died in his own integrity. There is something that the great mystical theologians speak about in the death itself as taking us through the conditions of this earth and showing that we come out the other side if we practice faithfully and lovingly and daringly the 100% uninterrupted, no exceptions, kenosis, the letting go, the entrusting into that higher relational field of love. If we do that, we come out the other end, and not only do we save our own skins, but in a deep way, the energy of that higher orientation, that beyond deathness, flows back into this earth as a liberation. And Jesus went through death as our guide, as our model, as our sacramental boost to help us do it, because it seems so much like the end to us in our little finite, separated selfhood. So my sense is this, that there is a whole different take on Jesus. There's a whole different understanding of what is meant by the Paschal mystery, the crucifixion, the at-one-ment rather than the atonement, but that you have to go deeper into that mystical knowing in order to get it, because it transcends the capacity of the operating system of the binary mind to get it. So as more and more people are ready to take a wager that there was more going on in here than punishment and judgment, that there was a voluntary love going on that's efficacious in the world today, then you can enter it with fewer booby traps and discover it holds. But I'd encourage you and other listeners out there who stumble on this, because it's a big one, to just immerse yourself in the in the literature of people like, you know, like Edith Stein, the great Carmelite mystic, and others who have voluntarily laid down their lives out of a greater love and a not wanting to disrupt the wholeness of that love. And just steep yourself in that kind of an understanding, and then begin to live out of that understanding, because that higher understanding will gradually replace and soften and gentle the energy of this virulent lower understanding.
Beautiful. That's incredible. And I use the model.
I'm sorry. There's so many other questions. I don't want to invite you to have a longer conversation. But thank you, because this was very rich. There are a whole bunch of folks who've typed in questions, Cynthia. Deborah in San Rafael asks, what are these new non-dual structures neurologically? And Xavier in the UK asks, nowadays mindfulness and neuroscience are claiming how important it is to make contact with the direct experience of living as it happens in the body here and now. Centering prayer does not seem to promote the embodiment of experience, but rather takes you into a consciousness beyond form. How does contemplation or centering prayer access the need for the embodiment of human experience? And Karen Harper in Indianapolis asks, is the brain wiring you speak of something physical, scientifically documented, or is this your way of representing a functional change in our thinking process?
Good questions, all of them. And I would say, no, it's not metaphoric. It is actual wiring. It's actual neurological changes that can be supported and documented. I'm not going to put on a neurosurgeon's hat or a neuro, you know, meditation person, because I don't have it, but I can refer people to any number of books out there, on many by Buddhists, on how meditation changes your brain. They don't all have centering prayer exactly right. I think that where centering prayer really works, you know, the reason they don't have it right is because they tend to take it as a concentrative meditation, meditative path, whereas they don't get this yet, the actual withdrawing of attention from subject-object configuration. But I think the people that are onto centering prayer better than anything else are in the Heart Math Institute, where they've been really sort of tracing what brings heart and brain into entrainment, and realize that any kind of constriction which is brought in by fear, negativity, or clinging will tend to push brain and heart out of entrainment. You know, the vibrational patterns become disordered and chaotic. And anything which allows a spacious letting be, a non-clinging, a non-insisting, a non-pushing away, will tend to foster a synchronization of heart and brain. And I think this is where centering prayer really, really reaches its stride. And the practice we do, letting go of thoughts in the meditation, carries over in the teaching and into life, and that capacity to do the same thing when you're out in daily life. And it's here where the revolutionary brain changes and the disposition for non-dual consciousness are really strengthened in centering prayer. But I want to come back to this other question that Xavier asked, which I think is absolutely on target, that there has not been sufficient emphasis in centering prayer to this state on the actual embodied nature of it. I've been talking about this right on from the beginning with the idea that the consent, the surrender, the letting go is actually physically embodied. It's a subtle movement in what you might call the nervous system, the etheric structure, and it actually happens. I think a lot of the language in the first generation of centering prayer teaching has been a disembodied language. That's been, you know, you get rid of your body, you get rid of your thoughts, you get rid of all form, and then something happens. I don't think that's the case. David Frenette is about to bring out a new book that really pushes further into how going beyond thought is not disembodiment, but real present moment immediacy. And I think that the next phase in centering prayer teaching and in the understanding, you're going to see it moving very strongly to a greater degree of embodiment, to people not worrying so much about, am I doing it right or wrong? Is this a thought? Or, you know, many, many people, I would say even today, the majority of practitioners, particularly new practitioners, do centering prayer in their heads. And I think the next generation of moving is going to be to teach you how centering prayer is actually done in the body and doesn't take you away from reality and doesn't take you away from the present, but brings you into non-conceptual presence, which is even more vivid.
Mm. Beautiful. Well, Cynthia, we've gone a little longer than I said we would. If you're willing to stay on long enough to take maybe one more live question.
Take one more live question, and then I'll have to wrap it up and get on down the road.
Okay. Well, there's one from the Instant Teleseminar that I definitely want to ask because it just feels so rich. But let's take a live question, and maybe we'll see what time we have. From Victoria, B.C., we have someone with no name on your caller ID. You're live.
Oh, well, Terry, it's Michelle Brown again. And I want to, because I didn't understand the technology, you have asked my question. It focused on the Trinity and the link to evolution. And not, of course, that question was posed that not all Christians are Trinitarians. There are a small group of us who are not Trinitarians. So I want to give up my time and turn it to that interesting question that you are hoping to have the time to explore.
Okay. Well, thanks, Michelle. Good to hear your voice. Well, let's go to there's two very different questions from Jan Willem in Doorn, Netherlands. If Jesus is a real non-dual teacher and we want to follow him, why any concern about the world in crisis?
Well, once again, it comes back to this definition of non-dual. And, you know, I found that even amongst my Advaitist friends, there's all sorts of different understandings about this. But I think the real Christian version of non-dual is the not one, not two, but one and two. And this was the part I was talking about when we had our conversation, Terry, where I said that, you know, so much of religious tradition and particularly a prevalent Eastern understanding of non-dual is simply that the whole world is a mirage, to be transcended by the power of the non-dual. The Western understanding of the non-dual is not there. It says you can see particularity from oneness. The image I use to talk about this or to help me visualize it is in a stained glass window when there are all those little bits, the red colors and the yellow colors and the blue colors, and they all shape into a pattern, and then the light hits it, and they get all of a sudden explode into a oneness. So it's a oneness that doesn't cancel out particularity, but it illumines particularity so that particularity becomes sacramental in a powerful way. And I think that's the tightrope Christians are called to walk, and Jesus walked, that this world is sacred and holy and contributes some specific thing, not in spite of its form and duality, but because and through its form and duality. And it takes a non-dual perception to unlock that. But if you know, it must be unlocked because that's where the heart of God lies.
Beautiful. Thank you. So that's the basis for a non-dual activism altogether.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So the last question, it's just a very personal and very heart-touching question. I just thought it would be lovely to end with this. Radha in London says, please, would you speak your thoughts about assisting my dear most in his dying process? He's a contemplative Buddhist and deeply on the path of the heart, which we share. However, he has a fatal illness, and he is now on very strong medications, which are clouding his awareness and depth. He is aware of this. My question is how best to support him on his journey whilst he is not able to touch his usual depth. Thank you very much.
That is a beautiful and heart-wrenching question. For me, one of the beautiful things about the canonic path of centering prayer is that you don't have to be in a strong state of mind to do it. You know, this learning that letting go is a path of holiness and gets you to exactly the same place as clear mind and sharp attention. Many people die in coma. Many people die in Alzheimer's. Many people die in dementia. And if you really hold the image that the individual mind must be clear to recognize its true nature, its Buddha nature, it's going to look like a train wreck at the end. But to realize that simply the letting go of resistance, the entrusting of self into the whole is as vibrant a practice, is as real, is as efficacious as the clarity of mind. So I think that's one important thing to keep in mind, to just encourage your beloved through your own bodily presence, through your own calm presence, to understand that all is held. Yes, go gentle into that good night, because the going gently is the recognition of the clear light. The other thing is, you know, from again, the Christians talk about this in a wonderful way, the communion of saints, we talk about it. I think the Buddhists would be comfortable with that in terms of interdependent arising. But the idea is we carry each other's burdens, and where one can't, the other does, because there's no boundaries between hearts. And so at that level, simply hold, we all must hold each other, because nobody can do it by themselves. And as you bring your love, your confidence, your gratitude for your beloved and for life itself, and hold the space which he can't touch because of the nature of his exit strategy, then nothing is lost. And you have to keep reorienting to, in the goodness of the whole, nothing is lost, and any sense of fear and loss will cloud that vision. So entrust, let go, move into it however it is, and the clear light is there because it's flowing up from the ground.
Thank you so much. That was just beautiful. Well, before I tell everybody about what's coming up next week, if you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com, or you can forward them one of the emails that announced this. And if you're interested in learning more about Cynthia's work, please visit the Contemplative Society at contemplative.org. You're also invited to go to terrypatton.com to get on my mailing list, find out about the Integral Community Seminar I mentioned, and the remarkable year-long training I'll be doing with Thomas Hubel, as well as the call on Wednesday. That's at birthinganewwe.com. And I want to remind you, if you want to make a donation to help Barack Obama be reelected, going to integralobama.com will enable you to do that. Now, in 3 weeks, on August 26th, I'll be talking with the brilliant integral philosopher Steve McIntosh, the author of the new book, Evolution's Purpose. And then later this year, in September, I'll be talking with Shyam Doge, the wet, hot, and wild American yogi, October 14th, Gonzo journalist Daniel Pinchbeck. And later this year, I'll be talking with trauma pioneer Peter Levine and Buddhist eco-philosopher Joanna Macy. Thank you so much for joining Cynthia and me today. Let's open up our lines now, and we can hear each other's voices say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Goodbye, and thanks for all listeners.
Thanks much.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was just great.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Beloved.
It was wonderful.
With grateful heart.
Great. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Presence here.
Thank you.
Okay, Cynthia, I'll give you a call now. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you very much. You can use either the cell or the landline.
All righty.
Probably
thanks.
The cell is better.
Okay, I will.
Okay, well,
bye-bye.
It was great talking with you.
Yeah, wonderful. Take care.
Sure, okay.
The moderator has left the conference. The conference is now completed.